Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Every Saturday and Sunday, we look back at the news and feature stories that were featured on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. A North Korean official arrived in New York City for talks with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo ahead of what the White House says is an expected summit between President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. The meeting comes as U.S. and North Korean officials discuss logistics for the possible Trump-Kim summit, again scheduled for June 12. VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff has the latest.
Plans for a U.S.-North Korea summit, once in jeopardy, are now apparently moving forward. Top North Korean official Kim Jong-chol is set to meet with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Top State Department officials were optimistic about the meetings, which will be held in New York. Heather Nauer, State Department spokesperson.
This will be the Secretary's third meeting with Kim Jong-chol. They've had obviously very deep conversations where they've talked about a lot of detail about what the United States' expectations are. Again, I'm not going to get ahead of those meetings. I'll let the Secretary handle it.
Kim Jong-chol is the highest-ranking North Korean official to visit the U.S. in nearly two decades. He attended the 2018 Winter Olympics this year as part of North Korea's delegation to the Games. The former spy chief was also reportedly involved in the 2014 cyber attacks that targeted Sony Pictures. His New York visit comes as a U.S. delegation talks with officials in North Korea's demilitarized zone, and teams on the ground in Singapore rush to finalize summit logistics. President Donald Trump, who abruptly called off the historic summit last week, is now moving forward, tweeting in part, quote, "Solid response to my letter. Thank you." Experts say the North Korean leader's decision to send his right-hand man to the U.S. is a promising start. Patrick McGeckern, Wilson Center Public Policy Fellow.
I think that the North Koreans have never wanted to pursue denuclearization. But I think that they're willing to entertain it in exchange for economic and security rewards. And so that's really, I think, the crux of the matter, to see if the United States and its allies can have leverage with the North Koreans to pursue our goals, which are the complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of North Korea.
Meantime, the White House confirms President Trump will meet with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on June 7th, just 5 days ahead of the potential peace summit in Singapore, in a meeting that is sure to include North Korea on the agenda. Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News, Washington.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's de facto chief of staff, Kim Chang-sun, traveled to Singapore as a U.S. delegation prepares for that meeting between the North Korean leader and President Trump. Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty what is amazing to him is the apparent role reversal underway, with Pyongyang actively engaged making sure the Singapore meeting takes place.
That's the first time ever that this has happened. In the past, this has always been the Americans, South Koreans, begging, bribing, trying to do anything to get the North Koreans to come and just talk. Here it's the North Koreans who appear to be desperate to have Mr. Trump come. And that is something very different. So this is quite a development to see finally, in sort of the 25 years I've been following, to see the North Koreans desperate to get to the table instead of vice versa.
Why the change in attitude?
I think this is the first time there's been a president who has really put the military option on the table. Other presidents have even, such as Mr. Obama, have specifically said, well, we're not going to use the military option. Trump is something new, and his warnings that military force might be used, I think, have been taken seriously. Plus, there has been a fair amount of pressure compared to the past put on the Chinese economically.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. Last Sunday, U.S. officials had begun meeting with North Korean officials in Panmunjom to discuss a potential summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The U.S. State Department confirmed that last Sunday. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said in a statement, preparations did continue to prepare for a meeting between the president and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Trump announced Thursday that he was withdrawing from the scheduled June 12th meeting in Singapore. Singapore, only to say on Friday that the summit might be back on. On Saturday, he said conversations about a potential summit were going along very well. In North Korea, state media reported Saturday that it is North Korea leader Kim's fixed will that a summit with Trump in Singapore should go ahead. South Korean President Moon Jae-in met Saturday with North Korean leader Kim near the two Koreas' heavily militarized border. The leaders exchanged views on how to prepare for the North's possible summit with Trump. The South Korean presidential office said that. After the meeting, South Korea's President Moon was upbeat. I asked Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at RAND Corporation Policy Think Tank, about his reaction to the ups and downs of the summit story so far.
Well, I think the expectation of the U.S. government was that it would all be ups, that Kim Jong-un had decided to take denuclearization seriously, and it was all going to proceed forward. But the history of working with North Korea is that they always like to get the last little ounce they can. They are serious about trying to get the details on their favor. And it's also not clear whether we've got some degree of misbehavior by North Koreans or what. I mean, they failed to show up for a meeting 2 weeks ago in Singapore with the American advance team. Hard to tell what was going on. Was this something Kim Jong-un was trying to marginally get some advantage out of? Or was this a case of people just not doing what he was telling them to? It's hard to tell.
Well, it is hard to tell, which of course must lead to speculation, which we don't always like to do, but sometimes we have to do it. And now the speculation is not only on what's happening in the White House as far as divisions within the White House are concerned, but also what do you have to say about the possibility of divisions in Panmunjom?
Well, I think certainly the potential for divisions within the North Korean government. I mean, Kim Jong-un has established control of the country based upon an extremely ruthless approach of killing a whole lot of people. There have to be a lot of his elites who really don't like him, and in particular don't like the idea of offering up their nuclear weapons as something that they're prepared to give up to get better treatment economically. So there could be some pushback, or this could be a strategy to move ahead. This could also be his charm offensive to try to take control of South Korea. Because he said his New Year's Day address, which is the State of the Union address for North Korea, he talked about unification a dozen times in that address, and he didn't mean a South Korean-led unification. He meant unification under his control. So is he working towards that as well? We just don't know.
How do we know that that's what he was talking about?
Oh, because the text of his message was published. And his family for decades has talked about unification, but when they have, it has always been the same message of this being unification under North Korean control.
Now, what about denuclearization? A lot is being made about the definition of denuclearization in the Korean Peninsula. What does that mean, do you think, to either of the leaders?
Well, first of all, Kim Jong-un has been anxious for a long time, and his father before him, to meet with the U.S. president and develop the appearance for internal political purposes that he's a peer of the American president. The nuclear weapons give him the feeling that he should be able to do that now, that he's got nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles that could potentially deliver them. And so a part of what he's anxious to do is to cement his internal control in North Korea. He wants to appear to be very powerful. In order to do that, denuclearization can't be a one-sided event. It can't be from his perspective that he's giving stuff up and not getting some comparable U.S. action. So he may well be trying to work to a position of saying, look, United States, you need to denuclearize too. That's only fair. And I'm your peer, President Trump, so talk with me about what nuclear weapons you're giving up.
Do you think that Donald Trump has met his match as far as a deal maker with Kim Jong-un?
Oh, I think quite the opposite, actually. I think Kim Jong-un has finally met his match. The North Koreans are used to Americans giving in to a certain extent and not really putting up anything in the way of response to the North Korean misbehavior. That's not what's happened with President Trump. Back when President Trump did his UN address where he talked about Rocket Man, Kim Jong-un wrote a personal response 2 days later, and he said two amazing things. Number one, he said, I didn't anticipate President Trump was going to say this. Well, wait a minute. In North Korea, Kim Jong-un is supposed to be the god. How is it that he can be a god and be fallible, that he didn't understand it? And the second thing he said was, it's a North Korean statement, a frightened dog barks louder. But the whole rest of his area of his statement is showing that he's barking louder, calling names and making threats. For once, Kim Jong-un is frightened by President Trump. I don't think he's been frightened, or his father before him, by previous American presidents.
Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation Policy Think Tank via Skype. Now in space, after lifting off last week, China's new Relay satellite is being tested as part of an unprecedented mission to land a spacecraft on the far side of the lunar surface later this year. The satellite will make possible communication between controllers on Earth and the Chang'e 4 mission scheduled in December. Brian Harvey is a Dublin-based space writer, author, and broadcaster. He told VOA's Victor Beatty this mission represents something entirely new for China's space program.
Up till now, China has focused primarily on reaching the same level of activity and technological development as the other space powers. And we have seen this in China's earlier lunar missions, in their first manned flights, and in building of a space station. But these are things that other countries have done before. No country has yet attempted a landing on the far side of the moon, and that is entirely new.
This is going to be a tricky maneuver, and there's no guarantee of success. How difficult is it?
It will be difficult. The Chinese seem to be fairly upbeat about it. China has had a very good record with its space missions. They have known very few failures, certainly compared to the United States and the Soviet Union in the early days of their space program. It is tricky. It is difficult. You're absolutely right. There is a possibility that this won't work. The launching was the first stage of a two spacecraft mission. The first spacecraft essentially is a small communications relay. It's about 485 kilograms. It will take 8 days to reach the moon, and it will then enter what's called a halo orbit, which is kind of describing a circle behind the moon so that it has the far side of the moon in continual view and is able to transmit to Earth at the same time. China has done a mission to this part of circumlunar space before, but the landing on the far side is, absolutely right, going to be the most critical, dangerous, and difficult part.
What is the significance of landing on the far side of the moon? What might scientists gather from that mission?
The far side of the moon is quite different from the near side. There are very few seas, what we from Earth see as the dark areas or the mare on the near side. The lunar far side is almost entirely uplands. It's very rocky. It's quite possible, we don't know, it's quite possible that the rocks there, the surface there, are the oldest part of the moon, and we may learn new science that we have not yet learned from the near side.
Brian, I understand at the same time, China celebrated the country's first rocket launch by a private spaceflight company. OneSpace Technologies, based out of Beijing. What is the significance there?
The launching the other day flew a rocket to 40 kilometers. Now, that's not very impressive compared to SpaceX's achievements so far, but it does mark the entry of private Chinese rocketeers into the launch market. And this company has every intention of launching spacecraft into orbit with rockets that will reach orbit. So it signifies the entry of Chinese private commercial companies into the private space rocket building industry.
Brian Harvey said 2018 is an ambitious year for China, which is expected to conduct no fewer than 40 rocket launches, surpassing both the U.S. and the old Soviet Union in launching the most satellites. Some 200 people who traveled to Australia for the Gold Coast Commonwealth Games have applied for refugee visas. That's a sharp increase from previous estimates. Athletes from several nations, including members of some African national teams, disappeared from the Games village in Queensland last month. From Sydney, Phil Mercer had the story.
Refugee campaigners believe some of the 200 Commonwealth Games athletes and support staff who are seeking asylum don't want to go home because they fear they'll be persecuted because of their sexuality. Another 50 participants whose visas have expired have yet to contact Australian authorities, but would still be able to apply to stay. Officials won't confirm their nationalities, but reports say they're from Cameroon, Rwanda, Sierra Leone and Uganda. Sarah Dale is a solicitor from the Refugee Advice and Casework Service, which is acting on behalf of some of the asylum seekers.
We've heard lots of examples in the media recently, such as people who fear harm based on identifying as homosexual. In a number of Commonwealth countries, it is criminalised to be homosexual. So it's certainly our experience that we will see some people who are granted protection. But as for the overall figures, we're not going to know that until the end of processing.
Initially, it was thought only about a dozen people hadn't returned home when the Games in Queensland State finished in the middle of April. The official number of athletes and staff has been disclosed at a parliamentary hearing in the Australian capital, Canberra. Australia's Department of Home Affairs said it would try to assess the applications as quickly as possible, but didn't specify how long the process would take. The assessment of some of the claims has already started. About 8,000 people arrived in Australia for the Commonwealth Games, an event held every 4 years that brings together members of a global grouping that emerged at the end of the British Empire. In 2006, after the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne, 45 people either overstayed their visas or claimed asylum in Australia. The government in Canberra is increasing its annual intake of refugees this year to 18,750 people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You are listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Smog, industrial waste, contaminated water, just a few of the environmental problems facing many of the biggest cities around the world today. But there is another type of pollution that's becoming increasingly prevalent in our cities. Noise pollution. Medical experts say people exposed to constant noise can suffer from a variety of psychological and physical ailments. As VOA's Behzad Hamdard narrates for reporter Salim Shayan, it is an especially serious problem in megacities like Karachi in Pakistan, where noise is a constant companion.
When someone calls on me, I don't hear them. There's so much noise. I get really angry, but what can I do? I have to manage traffic, but there's a lot of noise here.
Like Constable Zubair, many of the city's residents are fed up with noise pollution. Most accept it as a fact of life in the city. But many are not aware that the constant barrage of noise may be harmful to their health. A recent survey shows noise pollution in Karachi is getting worse. Noise intensity is measured in units called decibels. Normal conversation is typically between 50 to 60 decibels, and the hum of the city traffic comes in at about 80 decibels. Experts say noise levels of up to 85 decibels may be irritating but are still considered safe. It's when it goes beyond that threshold that the human body starts to react. Noise levels above 100 decibels, about the same as the sound of a jet flying overhead, have been recorded recently in different parts of Karachi.
The main problem is obviously that it affects one's hearing, but aside from that, it can cause irritation, it can cause high blood pressure, to a point that it can lead to a heart attack.
In cities like Karachi, the main source of noise pollution is vehicular traffic. But industrial generators and factories play a big part as well.
The noise of traffic, bikes, generators, huge trucks. The ears after a while start hurting. Even when I go home, the noise is still buzzing in my ears.
If you must honk your horn, tap it. People here just place their hand on the horn and just not let it go. Truth is, this says that person has no feelings.
There are currently no laws to control noise pollution in Pakistan. While the issue of excessive noise has recently started gaining traction as an election issue in some municipalities, experts say don't hold your breath. For now, they say it's up to individuals to police themselves. Go easy on the car horn and wear earplugs. For Salim Shayan in Karachi, Pakistan, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Last weekend was Memorial Day weekend in the United States, which for many marked the beginning of the summer season. Memorial Day is when the U.S. war dead are honored, and for more than three decades on the Sunday preceding Memorial Day, tens of thousands of motorcyclists have rumbled through the streets of downtown Washington. My colleague, VOA Asia's Jim Stevenson, has more.
The Vietnam War in the late 1960s and early 1970s was difficult for U.S. servicemen during and after the conflict. It was an unpopular war in the United States, and many questions have lingered about servicemen who were unaccounted and did not return home. The idea of a protest to address the issue was born in 1987 by Marine Corps Corporal Ray Manzo. In gathering support for his idea, he met Army Sergeant Artie Muller.
The more we investigated, the more we found out we just wanted to do something. We decided to do a demonstration down here. In the first 3 years, we did a march and a run. And then after that, we decided we're just going to do the run. And it went from 21 to 2,500 motorcycles the first year to last year, they said we had over 500,000 motorcycles and some 900,000 plus people.
Estimates of Vietnam POWs and MIAs have varied. Personal issues forced Ray Manzo to drop out of Rolling Thunder's annual planning. But with later wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Mueller has kept the demonstration going.
We're here to demand the government do something about the lives they left behind. We're also here to support our troops that are serving now, to tell our government, if you want to direct our military and tie their hands, then they better put a uniform on themselves and tie their own hands and let somebody shoot at them. Don't put our military in harm's way and make them tie their hands.
Sergeant Mueller's wife, Elaine, is also heavily involved in Rolling Thunder.
It was going to be a march and a few motorcycles. And this went on for about 2 or 3 years, and it seemed like the marchers decreased and the motorcycles increased. And since it was named after a bombing mission in Vietnam, it seemed really appropriate. It's not that we're a motorcycle club, but many clubs do support us. It just escalated.
And she says the Rolling Thunder demonstration is not just about Vietnam-era soldiers.
We're supportive of all veterans, and we're very supportive of our military. So that's why we continue our mission. It's the POW issue, but also we do a lot in VA hospitals. And through Rolling Thunder Charities, we're now helping needy military families and veterans who need help.
The throngs of motorcycle riders come from all across the United States each May. Michael Edwards is the president of a Rolling Thunder chapter in Wisconsin.
It's about a 15-hour ride, 16-hour ride. They leave Green Bay, Milwaukee, Chicago, go to Buckeye Lake, Ohio, stay overnight. And then they arrive on Friday afternoon about 1 or 2 o'clock here in Washington, D.C. But the total group, plus Rolling Thunder members, is probably 120, 130 bikes from Milwaukee.
And as a veteran, he says the issues pressed by Rolling Thunder remain very serious.
We took the same oath of office as these legislators did, and the same oath of office that the president took, to defend the Constitution of the United States. And we take it seriously. Even though some of us have been out of service for 40 years, we're still veterans.
Virtually every military veteran among the sea of motorcycles staged in the Pentagon parking lot in Virginia echoed the same sentiment about their ride into the nation's capital just across the Potomac River.
This is a First Amendment right. It's the freedom of speech, and we're not going to be silenced.
The Mueller say applications for permits to hold Rolling Thunder next year will be submitted on Tuesday, the day following Memorial Day. In Washington, Jim Stevenson, VOA News.
Memorial Day in the United States, observed on the last Monday of May, honoring the men and women who died while serving in the U.S. military. Originally known as Decoration Day, it originated in the years following the U.S. Civil War and became an official federal holiday in 1971. Many Americans observe Memorial Day by visiting cemeteries or memorials, holding family gatherings, and participating in parades. Unofficially, it marks the beginning of the summer season. We honored this day and the members of the military who gave their lives to this country with an episode from StoryCorps, a series of features based on people's experiences in their own words. Alan Ho was a combat medic in the Vietnam War. Continuing that legacy of service, both his sons joined the military. In January of 2005, Alan's older son, First Lieutenant Nanoa K. Ho, was killed in action in Iraq. A few months later, Alan visited Washington, D.C. for Memorial Day ceremonies at the Vietnam Women's Memorial. There he met Paula Coughlin, an Army nurse just back from Iraq.
I thought it would be great to welcome these young trauma nurses with some special Hawaiian lei. And I saw this Army nurse come walking up the path. And I said, here, this is a special gift from me to you. And she put her head down so I could put the lei over her shoulder. She noticed the button that I was wearing on my chest. Then she just put her finger on it, and she said, I know him. I said, how do you know him? He was my son. And she said, I was the trauma nurse at the crash unit where he died. And she said, I will never forget that face. Both of us kind of looked at each other, and we started crying, and I gave her a big hug. But I could sense that something was bothering her, and I thought she may have sensed that my family might have been disappointed at the fact that our son, his life could not have been saved. And I said, I want you to know that my son was a warrior. He absolutely recognized all of the risks that were involved. She cried, and she said that as the head trauma nurse, one of her tasks was to prepare his body for his men to have a last feeling. And she said that she tried to close his eyes, but as she went to press his lids together, they always would come open just a little bit. And she said that had bothered her all this time. And I looked at her and I laughed. And she kind of gave me this puzzled look. And she was like, I'm curious now, why are you laughing? And I said, my son would sleep with his eyes partially open. His men, when they were in combat, they were never certain what they could do when the lieutenant was sleeping, because they never knew if he was sleeping or he was just awake watching what they were doing. And I said, the simple fact that you shared that story with me totally convinces me now that you were with my son at the end. Now, I never have to wonder about those last final moments.
Our thanks to StoryCorps and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. South Korean President Moon Jae-in Monday suggested his impromptu get-together Saturday with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un could herald much more meetings to, in his words, expedite faster advancement of inter-Korean relations. He even suggested he could participate in a three-way summit with the North and the United States next month. That summit appears for now to be on track, with U.S. and North Korean diplomats having met at least through the middle of the week at the Truce Village of Panmunjom. The U.S. delegation was led by veteran State Department Korea expert Sun Kim. President Donald Trump cast doubt on the summit Thursday when he called it off, but then quickly announced it could be back on track. Tufts University assistant professor and chair of the Kim Koo Korea Foundation, Sung Yoon Lee, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Mr. Trump should have held firm and not agreed to take part in Singapore until Pyongyang offered meaningful concessions.
Now the U.S. has gotten North Korea to chase after the United States instead of the North Koreans calling the shots. It's very much in the North Korean strategic playbook They agree to meetings, they agree to agreements, and then violate them, and then cancel meetings, walk out right in the middle of negotiations, and they are able to get the other party, often big powers like the U.S., sort of hanging, chasing after North Korea. And of course, in interpersonal relations, in secular life, the party that plays hard to get always enjoys the greater leverage.
How do you account for the president's withdrawal and then reinsertion of the U.S. into a proposed U.S.-North Korea summit?
Well, I think the president always wanted to effect the summit meeting. He wanted to meet with Kim Jong-un, perhaps moved by hubris or an underestimation of the North Korean leader, or even dreams of winning the Nobel Peace Prize. He has shown much zeal, eagerness in meeting with the North Korean dictator. So I think he grew a little fed up that the North Koreans were a no-show in the preparatory meeting scheduled in Singapore. I think he was insulted perhaps by North Korea's harsh rhetoric in recent days by Kim Kye-kwon and Madam Choi, Choi Soon-hee. But of course, he has been called a mentally deranged dotard in response to his name calling of Kim as a rocket man on a suicide mission. So the latest vile rhetoric or disparaging remarks are not really anything new. So I think he was showing his frustration and maybe doing a bit of posturing. And I guess that was effective because Trump's very discourteous letter snubbing Kim Jong-un, canceling the show, the summit meeting, engendered an uncharacteristically civilized North Korean response. But it was a very short-lived leverage because in 24 hours, President Trump changed his mind.
A U.S. diplomatic team is at the truce village of Panmunjom meeting with North Korean counterparts. Obviously, they're preparing for this potential summit coming up next month. But the two sides completely disagree, I believe, on the definition of what denuclearization means.
In North Korean mind, denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula means really the abrogation of the U.S.-South Korea alliance, complete expulsion, eviction of U.S. troops and U.S. military assets from the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. has something very different in mind, of course. Sung Kim, as we know, is a former U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Policy, as well as U.S. Ambassador to South Korea. He knows the technical stuff. He knows, you know, what to do and what to say. At the same time, his counterpart reportedly is Madam Choi, Choi Soon-hee, a daughter of a former North Korean premier, whose strong words led to President Trump's cancellation of the summit. So in a way, the U.S. is kind of normalizing Ms. Choi and the North Korean state, Choi Soon-hee, threatened, quote, nuclear-to-nuclear showdown. And to sit down with her, to have a high-ranking U.S. official to negotiate with her in person just a few days later does send the wrong message.
Sung Yoon Lee said the Kim Moon meeting Saturday suggested to him a certain vulnerability on the part of the North Korean leader whose long-term planning has been interrupted by global sanctions. He said while the North Korean leader is looking for both sanctions relief and legitimacy for his regime, a long, drawn-out negotiation process with the U.S. will allow him time to advance his nuclear capability. The White House said it planned to impose 25% tariffs on $50 billion worth of Chinese goods that contain industrially significant technology as trade talks between the United States and China continue. The White House said Tuesday the proposed tariffs are in response to China's practices with respect to technology transfer, intellectual property, and innovation. It will announce the final list of covered imports by June 15th. Other punitive steps include implementing stronger investment restrictions and enhanced export controls for Chinese citizens and companies related to the acquisition of industrially significant technology to protect national security. The proposed investment restrictions and export controls will be announced by June 30th of this year and adopted shortly thereafter, according to the White House. In addition, the Trump administration said trade talks with China will continue. Mary Lovely is a professor of economics at Syracuse University with expertise in international trade and investment, as well as China's trade and sustainable development. I asked her if Tuesday's announcement was unexpected.
No, we knew that there was going to be the list announced. They finished hearings that they had, so it wasn't totally unexpected. People do view it as putting more pressure on the Chinese ahead of the meeting with Commerce Secretary Ross. So in some sense, the big announcement was a little bit unexpected.
The reaction from Beijing seems to be somewhat understated. I do not have it in quotes here, but I'm sure you have read it. Did that surprise you at all, or is this part of something that's already pre-planned?
Well, they're in pretty close contact with the Americans on this, and I think that they're certainly trying to avoid a trade war with the United States, and so they're going to play it cool. They certainly would prefer that this thing end up as some kind of negotiated deal. I think they thought that deal was pretty close. So I don't think they're going to overreact. However, if down the road tariffs are placed on $50 billion worth of Chinese exports, we will see the Chinese responding in a much stronger fashion.
Do you expect to see that happen?
No, but it does concern me. My own research shows that these tariffs are not good for U.S. Interests, that they're mostly on supply chain trade, that is trade of our multinational companies, particularly in the technology field. So I fear that it would hurt the competitiveness of our companies, suggest, push some companies to assemble or produce offshore. So I think it's a big negative for the American economy, not a positive, as some people might think. And we're certainly hoping that it can be avoided.
What part has and will the whole ZTE situation play in this?
Well, the ZTE thing, I mean, clearly that was important to the Chinese. And Trump has taken some political heat for doing what he did. I think it's responding pretty clearly that he wants more from the Chinese as a result of whatever he feels he gave them with ZTE. So I think that ZTE is there in the background. He's also signaling that he needs to be tough with China on the issues related to intellectual property theft or unfair compensation for the use of American technology. So the Congress, as you know, has been making a lot of noise about this. President Trump's going to have to take a strong stance on this. The ZTE seemed to signal that he was going to be weak on that front. That's definitely not going to be supported by the Congress.
One would think that there are back channels on this thing between the two countries. You agree?
I'm sure there are. However, I believe that the communication is not always very clear. As an example, I think that the Chinese are spending a lot of time trying to read President Trump's tweets. But, hey, why should they be any different than the rest of us? We're also trying to keep up with what particular tweets mean. So one hopes that at the somewhat lower levels, there is more communication between the two sides. They seem to be communicating a little bit better, particularly with Secretary Mnuchin after his statement. Now it's anybody's guess.
You think there's a split in the White House as far as where some advisors are standing and trying to counsel the president about it?
We've certainly seen that. I mean, we know there was some bickering while they were in Beijing. We know that Ambassador Lighthizer, for example, takes a much stronger stance, is much more pro-levying tariffs than, say, Secretary Mnuchin. There's definitely a split. I think that really complicates communication with the Chinese. I think it probably frustrates the Chinese, who would like to see some deal. I'm worried that it will prevent the U.S. from getting the best outcome that they can get. There are clearly issues that need to be addressed. We have an opportunity to address them, and I'd hate to see this opportunity just end up with a few extra $1 million worth of soybeans or sorghum purchase. That's not a long-term solution to the issue.
Ross is set to go to Beijing this week to negotiate on how China might buy more American goods to reduce the huge U.S. trade deficit with Beijing, which last year totaled $375 billion. As tensions were easing over a potential trade war while negotiations between the U.S. and China continued, the uncertainty about tariffs and the eventual impact on the U.S. agricultural industry was taking a toll on U.S. farmers heading to the fields to plant this year's crops. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reported, there is a lot at stake, not just for farmers, but also the companies that supply them.
It's been almost two decades since Illinois farmer Scott Halpin's family drove a newer tractor through the fields of Grundy County. Thankfully, the equipment his family uses is well-serviced and, so far, reliable. Hopefully that doesn't change anytime soon, because Halpin says he can't afford it.
Not under this farm economy.
The iconic green and yellow tractors the Halpins own are made in America by John Deere, headquartered in Moline, Illinois. John Deere saw a surge in sales and profits in the early part of 2018, but that was before aluminum and steel tariffs were imposed by the U.S. on China. Now Deere, which uses steel in its equipment, plans to increase prices for 2019 models to protect profits. That means it won't be getting cheaper for Halpin to make a new purchase.
The increased cost of equipment with the declining farm economy right now doesn't make it real smart for us, or doesn't make it what we want to do for our farming operation here.
For companies like John Deere and Caterpillar, they really get hit on both sides of the trade dispute spectrum.
Mark Grivicheski is an investment advisor with the Quad Cities Investment Group and explains that the cost for farmers and their suppliers to do business expands beyond the additional tariffs of 25% on imported steel and 10% on imported aluminum imposed by the U.S.
So if John Deere makes a routine purchase of $10 million of imported steel, they now have to cut another check for $2.5 million to the federal government, and that increases their operating costs. On the other side, you have China threatening the U.S. with $150 billion of their own tariffs, primarily targeting the U.S. agricultural industry. Not only does that impact farmers, but it impacts those companies with ties to the farming industry.
Increased costs for farm equipment and concerns about competitive access to a big market like China, which has depressed prices for corn and soybeans, is creating the perfect economic storm for farmers like Halpin.
The decline in the market has a daily effect on every farm in this country.
So does the relentless news about renegotiating trade deals and tariffs. What Halpin says he wants most, almost as much as favorable weather this year for his crops, is some sense of stability.
With the negotiations, the way they're happening, it can hurt when things happen on a daily basis. It's just kind of uncertain times here in farming.
A time when, even before new tariffs, the United States Department of Agriculture projected net farm income in 2018 to reach a 12-year low. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Moline, Illinois.
Thank you for being with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Last month, the U.S. Embassy in Guangzhou, China, issued a health alert stating that a U.S. government employee in that city had experienced strange audio-related sensations. The next day, a physical examination of the employee revealed symptoms that match a mild traumatic brain injury. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the symptoms were very similar and entirely consistent with the health issues that American diplomats in Cuba reported in August of 2017. Those symptoms were blamed on so-called sonic attacks.
We're concerned about it. It's a serious medical incident. We want to make sure and take care of every one of our officers serving overseas. We've learned about it only recently. We are still trying to identify all the circumstances surrounding it.
But was it really an attack, either in China or in Cuba? I spoke via Skype about that with Timothy Layton, professor of ultrasonics and underwater acoustics at Southampton University in the UK.
I think there's insufficient evidence to link the two.
I would also say there is insufficient evidence to link the Cuba incident to a sonic attack. That's not to say it's impossible, but that is to say that it's unlikely, and also to say that the reporting I saw of the Cuban incident was rather selective and tended to be overblow things, to take things out of context and proportion.
So what do you think happened in either or both cases?
I actually get approached by quite a lot of people who say they have been suffering some kind of sonic attack. They have a strange set of symptoms, headache, nausea, tinnitus, a ringing in the ears, migraines, and they think they've been attacked by some other person who's directed sound at them. And I always go through a process of elimination to try and work out with them what is the cause of their problem. And the first thing I do is try and find out if it's due to anything else, because you can have the same set of symptoms caused by stress, anxiety, an infection, poisoning, something like that. And in fact, ultrasound as a weapon is not a great weapon to use. You can't fire it in a rifle over a distance of one city block or something like that, or even a hundred yards. It doesn't travel well through air. It gets absorbed and it gets bounced off walls. And most importantly, it's an unpredictable device. It's very hard to predict who will be affected by it. If you expose someone to ultrasound and really, or high intensity, high frequency sound, the children might hear it and feel unpleasant symptoms, inability to concentrate, headache, something like that. But the people who are most robust against attacks, the people who really you find it hard to affect with high frequency sound, are the adult men, because they've lost their high frequency hearing. They can't hear it. And so embassies have a lot of adult men in them. And so if you're going to attack an embassy, it's a strange weapon of choice, both because it's unpredictable and because the adult men are the most robust against such an attack. Now, looking from one perspective, you can say, here's this very strange set of symptoms, headaches, nausea, tinnitus, and a ringing in the ears, and perhaps people have heard something, and therefore link that to a sonic attack. Looking the other way, you can say, if somebody becomes stressed or anxious, these are the symptoms they get. Doesn't matter what the cause of the stress is. It could be fingers being scratched down a blackboard. It could be worrying about exams tomorrow. It's headaches, nausea, tinnitus, stress. So it can be one way of looking at it. And I think this was the way that most of the authorities and the media took, was to say this is a sonic attack because of this strange set of symptoms. The other way is to say, here's a strange set of symptoms you can get from many other sources.
Have you ever come across a real sonic attack? And, if so, how did it manifest itself? How was it done?
I've never come across a real one. So every time that I've ever come across this, it's been an accidental exposure from technology that you can pick up quite cheaply.
Well, if you could come up with something that erases the effects on a lot of people of screaming infants on airplanes, you wouldn't have to work another day in your life.
I know. That's the classic sonic attack.
Timothy Layton, professor of ultrasonics and underwater acoustics at Southampton University in the UK. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. A privately run women empowerment program in Pakistan known as Pink Rickshaw is helping improve the lives of poverty-stricken families and impacting social behaviors in an otherwise male-dominated society. We heard more from Ayaz Gul in Islamabad.
Women in the driver's seat of a three-wheeled auto transport service were a rare sight in Pakistan until very recently. The pink autos, unlike their male-driven green counterparts, exclusively serve women who often complain of harassment while using public transport.
The other motivation was to provide safe rides for women who can't drive themselves or don't have the ability to own a car, financial ability to own a car. And these were the women who get really harassed on the streets regularly all the time.
Environmentalist Zar Aslam conceived and launched the first of its kind project in 2015 in her native city of Lahore. She says the number of rickshaws has since increased to 17, though it is still very small.
It has opened up the minds of people. It has changed the lives of the women who are driving it. It's changed the lives of their families. And for a lot of men and for a lot of younger men, when they see their mothers driving it or their aunts driving it, the pink rickshaw, they grow up with the idea. And that is a huge change.
Women who are trained and given rickshaws on easy installments often come from impoverished families. Some used to work as maids in private homes, while others were just daily wage laborers. But after joining the pink rickshaw program, say the beneficiaries, their monthly incomes have increased by 300%. Pressure from male family members, men competitors, and traffic constables were initially discouraging, say these women. But those behaviors gradually have turned positive, and they now hardly face any incidents of harassment.
Once I was penalized for a minor traffic violation, I didn't have enough money at the time to pay the fine. A traffic warden paid the amount for me, saying, "Sister, the penalty has imposed, but we can help you this way."
The non-profit Pink Rickshaw organization uses donations from friends and family members to sustain the operation. Officials say the program is attracting women to join it, but financial challenges hamper expansion efforts. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
For transgender people in a conservative country like Pakistan, life starts getting tough very early. Seen as misfits in society, they're misunderstood, shirked, and forced to live away from families. While they get little help from the government, for the first time, one of their own has built a senior home for them. VOA's Aisha Tanzim visited the house in Lahore and brings us this story.
Severa is HIV positive. She's also one of the thousands of transgenders in Pakistan who are routinely shunned by their families and thrown out of their houses at an early age.
My mother is the only one who loves me. No one else likes me because I am a transgender. All my relatives and neighbors make fun of me. Even my own siblings make fun of me.
Rejected by their loved ones, they usually turn to a guru, an older transgender who provides shelter and training on how to make a living. As social outcasts in a conservative society, they do not have many options for employment. Most of them dress as drag queens and dance for men at parties, work as sex workers, or beg. As they grow older, the sources of income dry up. Guru Ashif Bhatt had seen one too many transgenders left to die on the streets. So she decided to build a home for old or sick transgenders. Even that received resistance from the community.
I wanted to build it in the city, but people came to me and said, "You will keep sick transgenders here. They will have AIDS or hepatitis C. Our children will get sick and old transgenders will roam around in our neighborhood."
She was forced to move her project to an area outside the city. Here, she provides not just accommodation, but food to people like Mehek, who has polio.
I can't roam around and beg too much because I get tired. Here, even if I can go and beg every day, I don't have to worry about how I will eat or pay my rent.
This first-of-its-kind shelter home for transgenders in Pakistan can only accommodate up to 40 people. Pakistan has more than 10,000 transgenders. But wants the government to take more interest in the welfare of a neglected community in desperate need of support. Meanwhile, Severa is grateful for the reprieve since she spends all her resources trying to pay her medical bills. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Lahore.
We are happy you are with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Overwhelming sense of pride and optimism has gripped Malaysia following the stunning defeat of a widely despised but powerful government implicated in one of the world's greatest corruption scandals. In an exclusive interview with VOA, the new Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, made it clear he was under no illusions about the amount of work to be done to restore the country's reputation and its finances, but also distanced himself himself from any blame for the damage done following his previous administration. David Boyle has this report from Kuala Lumpur.
It's 3 weeks since they voted out their government for the first time in more than six decades, and Malaysians are getting back to work with a spring in their step. Their hero is Mahathir Mohamad, the former Prime Minister, who came out of retirement aged 92 and united with his former political opponents to topple a regime accused of massive graft. The public is reading all about it as fresh details pour out from an investigation into how billions of dollars disappeared from 1MDB, a state fund overseen by ousted Prime Minister Najib Razak. The scandal and a litany of others under Najib, who has denied all wrongdoing, has humiliated a country that had thrived economically under Mahathir, who is now widely heralded by many Malaysians as a saviour.
We are now feel very blessed. We are now feel very blessed because Tun Mahathir able to stand up for us. Thank you so much, Mahathir.
I cannot say much, but I'm so proud of this.
In an exclusive interview, Mahathir told VOA the task of restoring Malaysia's finances and reputation following the damage inflicted by the previous government was immense.
Well, my first 20 years as Prime Minister was fairly easy. I inherited a system that is already there. All I have to do is to introduce new ideas so that we can expedite the growth and development of Malaysia. But here, I'm dealing with a country that has been actually destroyed.
Mahathir says the new government has already found ways to knock off about a fifth of Malaysia's national debt, which ballooned to more than $250 billion under Najib. On Monday, he announced he would drop a multi-billion dollar high-speed rail project connecting the capital with Singapore, saying it was expensive and unnecessary. To topple Najib, Mahathir joined forces with Anwar Ibrahim, a former deputy who he once jailed following a political spat before Najib did the same. But he flatly rejects any suggestion that his own heavy-handed use of executive power in his previous two decades of rule had any influence on the abuses that followed. Political analyst Wong Ching Huat says Mahathir does have to shoulder some of the blame for what followed after he stepped down in 2003. But he also believes his commitment to reform now is rock solid.
I think a lot of people are still celebrating the fact that we have a good government. But no good government lasts unless you have a good opposition. You need good opposition to check on them, to be prepared to stand in and replace them.
Malaysians are bursting with pride after a watershed moment for their country. But the battle to create a lasting optimism is only just beginning. David Boyle for VOA News in Kuala Lumpur.
An analyst at the London-based banking and financial services firm HSBC said for the first time, China's box office surpassed that of the United States during this year's first quarter, taking in more than $3 billion in receipts compared to $2.85 billion in the U.S. Gary Guo said the Chinese film industry has grown significantly over the past 9 years with rising incomes, more cinemas, and better quality movies like Operation Red Sea, Detective, Chinatown 2, and Monster Hunt drawing large crowds. Ben Cavender, director of the Beijing-based China Market Research Group, spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty from Shanghai about the domestic movie industry's growing success.
China's economy has continued to hold up pretty well, especially when you look at consumer spending. And so I think you have a case of consumers, especially in certain fourth-tier markets, looking at more entertainment opportunities, and that's leading them to head to the box office. I think also at the same time, Chinese movie studios are putting out a lot more high-quality content than they were previously, and they're offering more sequels maybe than they did in the past. So they're starting to now be movie brands that consumers are able to return to.
What kind of movies are the Chinese going to see?
It's a mix. I think you have lighthearted comedy type movies that are starting to do pretty well, but also you're getting more sort of big budget action movies that are very sort of China-centric or China becomes more global. I think that theme is going over very well right now and is picking up a lot of potential moviegoers.
Of course, we know that corporate America has sometimes a pretty tough time getting to the Chinese market. Does Hollywood find the same obstacles?
Certainly, for getting to China, yeah, there's a difficulty. There's a cap on the number of foreign films that can be screened here. So actually getting on the list to be one of those films can be difficult, and studios kind of have to take a gamble about which films they put forward and which films they think are going to actually do well in China. You know, an example of that would be you look at Star Wars properties and how they perform in the U.S. versus how they perform in China. In the U.S., they're very popular because you have decades of fan awareness of the properties, whereas in China, the allure just isn't there. And so, you know, one after the other, they end up being duds here. But I think over the longer term, Hollywood's getting better at understanding the Chinese market. You're seeing a lot more product placement of Chinese brands in Hollywood movies, a lot more Chinese actors being used, and then also a lot more use of Chinese studios on the post-production side of things in order to get around some of the caps for getting movies into the China market.
ENT Group, a market research firm, is forecasting China's box office will surpass $14 billion and revenues from sectors linked to the movie industry to exceed $31 billion by 2022. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Make sure you join us again next week, and make sure you check our website at voanews.com for all the latest news, information, and features.